Session number 30079, Reel 2.
You mentioned before going to England. When was it that you were to leave Australia? Do you recall?
No, I can't recall exactly. We left from Sydney, though, in a converted liner into a troop carrier.
What were your feelings like? What were the feelings like associated with the thoughts of going overseas?
Quite a sinking feeling when we saw the Sydney heads disappear on the horizon. And it was an American ship, and we didn't know where it was headed. But some of the navigators, the trainee navigators on board, were trying to keep a log of where we were travelling. And at one stage we looked like we're heading for the Antarctic. They did a zigzag course across the Pacific to San Francisco, where we were disembarked.
What was it like to get to a place like San Francisco?
Oh, outstanding.
What was life on board the ship like?
Well, we were kept fairly busy on the ship. The meals were catch-as-catch-can, and if they found any work for us to do, they did. But otherwise, it was quite uneventful, that part of it.
We're mentioning you heading off in 1943, and presumably you had no real knowledge of where you were going.
None whatsoever.
How did that sort of situation strike you? Here you are, a young bloke, not really knowing what he's up for. No one telling him anything necessarily.
Well,
what was that like?
It was quite good, really, because we were treated well in America. We were sent overland from San Francisco over to Massachusetts to a big staging camp over there. And it was quite interesting to see the different scenery of the states in the travel over there.
What do you remember of that time? What would you do in the staging camp at Massachusetts?
Well, we were paraded around the place, and the Americans were interested in some of our singing. They wanted us to sing Waltzing Matilda and all that sort of business on the camp. It was, as I said, it was a very large camp, and whilst we were there, there was an outbreak in our detachment of scarlet fever. So we were quarantined. We weren't supposed to leave the base at all. And most of us didn't, but some of them did jump the fence, I know. And we were there in all 6 weeks. Towards the end of that time, we were given the opportunity to either visit Boston, which was probably closer than where we were than what was New York. We could either go to Boston or New York, and I asked for New York.
So what was it like to go to New York?
Oh, amazing, amazing. I'll never get over it.
Well, let's talk about some of those experiences. What was associated with going, a young chap from Perth, boy from Bassendean, going to a place like New York, the Big Apple?
Yeah, like the Big Apple. Yeah, well, there was a lady who was going to billet us, apparently a wealthy American lady, but at the last minute she couldn't have us for some reason. I can't remember why, but she said, "I've booked you into Hotel 52nd Street.
Sounds right.
In the Big Apple. And the mate and I were billeted in a suite of rooms there. And from there we were allowed to go where we liked. And I can remember I saw Kodak House, and films for the camera were practically unobtainable right through Australia, and as far as I could make out, it was the same in America, but I thought, being Kodak House, surely they'd take pity on us. And certainly they did. They gave me a couple of films for my Kodak camera that I had. Mm. That was the end of it. But we did have a good time. We went to various nightclubs and broadcasting studios. Saw Frank Sinatra in his prime.
Let's talk about that. What was it like to see old Blue Eyes?
Well, I met this lass at one of the dances, and she said to me, "Would you like to go to the NBC studio?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And I was thinking it was going to be tomorrow, because this was midnight. And I said, "Oh, I arrange to meet you tomorrow." And she said, "No, it doesn't start till 1 o'clock in the morning." So we went to the NBC studio, and it was packed out with young teenage girls, mainly. And they were all oohing and aahing and swooning and carrying on when he appeared on stage. And I was fairly well back. I didn't get a first-hand look at him, but he looked like a scrawny, skinny-looking fellow as far as I could see. And he had all the girls in raptures. Mm. And I said to this lass that had invited me along, I said, "How come you're not swooning on the floor?" And she said, "Oh, I'm past all that."
Do you remember what he sang?
No, I don't. Would have been current at the time. But it was quite a thrill to know that I'd seen one of the film stars at least.
Let's talk then about New York a bit more. And people talk of how the Americans compared to the Australians.
Well, at the camp, it was Camp Miles Standish was the name of the American base that we were stationed on. And what I remember of it was that they would have an afternoon where ladies from the surrounding districts would come in, usually middle-aged women, they weren't young women, and any sewing that you needed done, if your socks need darning or you needed to have something sewn on your uniform, they were only too glad to help, and they seemed, you know, very generous in that regard.
How did the Americans see young blokes from Australia? You mentioned, obviously, that you were being asked to sing Australian songs.
That's right. Yeah, that was by the army people in the base.
How did the average civilian see you as an Australian soldier, Australian airman in New York?
Oh, I think they were very grateful that we were there, that we were showing that we cared about what was going on in the world. And for that reason alone, I think they accepted us.
What were your impressions of the average American?
That they're very generous people. That was the impression I got.
You mentioned going to various nightclubs. You mentioned, you know, seeing Frank Sinatra. What other sights did you see in New York? Now, they were talking about, you know, this metropolis.
Yes.
As comparison to sleepy old Perth.
Well, there was a group of us went up the Empire State Building to go as high as we could. You couldn't get to the absolute top in those days. And the group I was with, they were looking for something that resembled Australian beer. And as I remember, I've never been a drinker, and I wasn't really concerned with this, but the majority of the group were beer drinkers, and they found that up on the top floor of the Empire State Building there was a bar there that sold bottled beer, and they reckon that was the closest to Aussie beer, and that's as far as they wanted to go. So we just proceeded to do a bit of sightseeing around the place, and it was really eye-opening. And I think of the 3 nights that we spent there, we only got about 6 hours sleep in total. We just kept going all the time.
Mm.
And it was quite an exciting time. And many tales to tell once we got back to the staging camp. And it wasn't long after that that we were ready for further embarkation.
Well, what was involved? Were you to receive any further training in America, or...?
No, no training whatsoever. We had our own parades, kept in touch with our drills and marching procedures.
Presumably you would then be shipped off.
Yep.
What was involved?
Well,
where did you go next?
We were shipped to New York Harbour. And the ship there was quite a well-known troop carrier for the Atlantic run, which was the Aquitania. And we embarked, I can't remember the date, I don't know that I ever wrote it down anywhere.
But
still in 1943.
We're looking at a time, obviously, when the German U-boat it might be a concern. We're talking about travelling on open seas, troop carriers. What precautions did you experience, either on your way to America or on your way from America to England?
Yeah, well, we only had an estimate of how many troops there were on board the Aquitania, but some people mentioned 5,000 members, which consisted of not only Australians, but Americans as well. And there was hardly a spare square foot of deck space when you went out, because there was buds sitting around writing, playing cards, and you just had to find a spot for yourself.
I was going to ask what the average pastime was. It was all gambling. And
gambling, yeah, two up in cards. And I wasn't involved in any of that. I was a non-drinker and a non-gambler. And I've remained that way ever since. And time was occupied on the Aquitania in trying to get meals, because no sooner had you finished one meal than you had to queue up for the next one, because it went round and round the bowels of the ship. And it was 24 hours out, that strange you should mention the U-boats, because we're 24 hours out from New York and we were examined by a long-range German aircraft. I've never found out where it came from, but it was a four-engined Focke-Wulf Condor. We recognised it. It came out of the clouds and just looked us over. Didn't drop any bombs, but it was enough for the captain of the Aquitania to about turn. And he headed back to New York for so many hours, because this Focke-Wulf Condor would have radioed the U-boats in the Atlantic what was approaching. So the skipper of the Aquitania thought he'd outsmart them, and he did too. We got to England without any further hassle.
Let's talk about that trip. Here you are on the Aquitania, heading over to England.
Mm.
You know, obviously, you come back to New York and then head off again.
Yeah.
What precautions were taken on board ship? Did you have to...
I think some of us had been more or less directed to the gunnery crews to assist them with the guns that they had on board, the anti-aircraft guns. I wasn't involved in that.
Night watch?
No, I wasn't involved in that.
What were the rules and regulations that you had to follow in relation to precautions being taken on board ship? People talk of blackout.
Well, the blackout was paramount. You knew you weren't to show any lights whatsoever. Hmm. So that was respected. But the rest of the time was spent up, as I said, queuing for meals. And
what were your sleeping quarters like?
Very, very confined. And I can recall what did happen now before we reached England. It must have been an American Thanksgiving Day because they turned on this spread of pork, which we hadn't seen since we left home, a meal with pork in it. And everyone feasted on it. And it wasn't until the early hours of the morning that it had its effect on me, with this terrific gut ache. And I knew it was out of the ordinary. And I was later to find out it was food poisoning. And I went up on deck to see if I could find some sort of a hospital or situation that they could help. And I walked through a door where it had a red cross or something on it. And I opened my mouth to say something. And this guy had a big spoonful of white stuff. And he shoved it straight in my mouth. He knew exactly why I was there. There must have been a lineup of them. And eventually recovered. I wasn't too happy about pork from then on. But it must have been well and truly off. And there was a lot of people affected by it. But I forgave the Yanks for that.
What were you hearing about getting to a place like England? Were you being given any briefings or anything like that on board ship?
None whatsoever. We were told when we landed in England our final destination would be Brighton, down on the south coast. We landed in Scotland, a place called Greenock, in the Clyde, if I remember rightly. And we were put on troop train, must have been dark, and we travelled all night. And in the morning we were in Brighton. Didn't have to change trains or anything, stayed on the same train. And we were billeted on in what had been fairly splendid hotels, but they were really being stripped off for wartime, and there was no mod cons in them at all.
What was it like to get to Scotland? What was it like to actually be in the mother country?
Well, my first view of the Clyde was that I'd never seen so many ships in all my born days together. Was completely covered in ships. Must have been a safe anchorage. And I thought, looking at the land, what I could see of it, the grey buildings and the grey area around the place, it just disappointed me. You know, I expected to see a bit of colour, but there was no colour. It was just absolute grey. And, of course, we didn't see anything after we got on the train. At England, at Brighton was a different bit of a story.
All right, well, let's talk about the trip down to Brighton. What do you remember?
Don't remember anything.
You're just on the train?
And that was it. There was no stopping, as far as I know. We were only sitting up and slept as best we could. The only thing I could remember about their train was their third class was the equivalent of our first class in those days.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Nice upholstery. It didn't come up to the standards of the Americans, though.
No?
Well, no. Oh, well, theirs was an interstate train.
Well, here you are, heading towards Brighton. What was it like to get to Brighton?
Well, that was the first time we could get out to stretch our legs, I suppose. And we were allotted whichever hotel it was. I think it was the Grand Hotel. We were on a certain floor on there and you had an iron bed with an iron stretcher sort of business. And they more or less told you when you were to get together as a mob and have a bit of a march around the town. And I can remember the English instructor was very, very happy to tell us that Brighton had 600 hotels, or 600 pubs where you could get a drink. And that apparently attracted a lot of them. Didn't attract me, didn't worry me. But it looked like the waterfront at Brighton was all barricaded off. You couldn't get down to the beach at all. It was all barbed wire, and it was patrolled by the army.
Well, how did that affect you? Here you are in a war zone. This is a country affected firsthand by war. What were your impressions?
Well, you wondered whether there were going to be any bombs dropped for a start, because you weren't that far from London, which was been pretty well plastered. But it never happened. I don't think from memory we, at that stage, we even heard of a bomb coming down.